From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Clinton and Dole face off in Hartford, Connecticut, minus Perot and minus Nader.
This assertion by the bad that we have nowhere to go except to stay home and vote for the bad over the worst. That nowhere to go is one of the most outrageously arrogant political tactics in our generation.
Ralph Nader takes on Clinton and Dole, and progressives discuss their options in the 1996 elections.
Think of all the things that Clinton and Dole agree on. That cash assistance to poor children should no longer be a federal guarantee, while $200 billion in corporate welfare should go untouched. That Medicare and Medicaid should be cut while military spending is increased. That the private market is the only way to reform health care. Where Clinton once called for universal health care coverage in his 1992 campaign, now all he says is he'll appoint a commission to study how to better regulate HMOs and managed care. Where does that leave the 40 to 60 million people who have no health insurance? I tend to think of the fight between Clinton and Dole as being an argument over who should drive while we all get to go over the cliff.
All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now!, Public Broadcasting's only daily election show. I'm Amy Goodman. Last night, President Clinton and Bob Dole squared off in the first of two presidential debates. They were in Hartford, Connecticut, the insurance state and home of many corporate headquarters, probably the best symbol for the bonds that tie the two candidates, the corporate money flowing into both campaigns. In fact, the New York Times estimates that $1 billion will be spent on the presidential campaign. The corporate sponsors of the Commission on Presidential Debates that chose to exclude third-party candidates like Ross Perot and Ralph Nader are Philip Morris, the largest tobacco company in the world, Lucent Industries, a subsidiary of AT&T, Dun & Bradstreet, and Sara Lee, among others. But to discuss what the candidates disagreed and agreed on is Larry Venske. He's joining us from California, our national affairs correspondent. Good morning, a very early morning to you, Larry.
And a very late night.
So tell us, what do you think are some of the important issues, and again, I stress, disagreed and agreed on, that the candidates talked about last night?
Well, Amy, every survey of voters over the past however many decades has indicated that an overwhelming number of people in presidential elections vote on the economy, their own personal circumstances, their perspective on where the economy will be if one party or one candidate or another wins. And I think both candidates last night tried to address this question, Bill Clinton trying to say the glass is on its way to being full and Bob Dole trying to say the glass is on its way to being empty. What is curious to me is that their arguments are based on such spurious statistics in both cases. The Republicans keep repeating something that we've tried to analyze on Pacifica ever since the 100 Days of Congress show we did a year and a half ago from Washington, and the Contract with America's statement, which people may remember, that the average American pays more in taxes than what they spend on food, clothing, and shelter combined. Now, this is outright false, and Bob Dole repeated it again last night. For example, the Bureau of Labor Statistics recently reported the average family pays about $5,800 in all taxes, federal, state, local sales taxes, etc., $5,800, and the average family income is something around $34,000. So the expenditures for food, clothing, and housing in the United States, taxes are about a third of those expenses in reality. And yet, over and over again, from Newt Gingrich to Bob Dole, you hear this spurious statistic brought out to frighten people and scare them about what they're supposedly paying in taxes. Well, people have their own way of calculating their own lives and know very clearly what things cost, so they know that's false. On the other hand, President Clinton's consistent appeal to only the middle class about economic issues, neglecting the fact that we still have how many millions, 11 million poor children in the United States, and that his recent recently signed welfare bill will exacerbate that by at least 1 more million people. His constant ignoring of the housing crisis and the fact that people can't pay for shelter in the United States in an overwhelming number of cases in inner city circumstances, particularly President Clinton's continuing pandering to the people who are already the privileged in this country economically, is another thing that I think turns people off from the lower end of the socioeconomic spectrum. So from the middle class to the lower classes in the United States economically, there's a reality check that people have to make on their own lives, comparing it to the rhetoric of these candidates, and the rhetoric just doesn't stand up.
Well, Larry, we're going to move into the first excerpt from the debate, and that's on campaign finance reform. And I think there's a connection there, because perhaps they're saying that these candidates themselves, like Bob Dole, pays more in taxes than he actually does pay for housing and food, because they get so many perks. I mean, again, just as we were saying last night, look at where he lives. I mean, he lives in Florida, at least he has his summer home or his vacation home where he did his studying up for the debates. In Bal Harbour, he got that at a below market rate. He got his condominium at a below market rate from Archer Daniels Midland, a sponsor of the debates in the past, a big sponsor of Dole himself, gives money also to the Democrats, not to mention to Jim Lehrer's show, who was the moderator last night. The Jim Lehrer show gets millions of dollars from Archer Daniels Midland. So perhaps the reason they calculate it the way they do is because these guys don't pay a lot in housing, they don't pay a lot in food, and perhaps their taxes are a bit more. But let's talk about the issue of campaign finances and possibly even campaign finance reform and what the candidates had to say last night about it.
Mr. President, the senator mentioned trial lawyers and campaign, that means campaign financing. How do you personally avoid being unduly influenced by people who give you money or give you services in your campaigns?
Well, I try to articulate my positions as clearly as possible, tell people what I stand for, and let them decide whether they're going to support me or not. The senator mentioned the trial lawyers. In the case of the product liability bill, which they passed and I vetoed, I think that's what he's talking about. I actually wanted to sign that bill, and I told the people exactly what the Congress, exactly what kind of bill I would sign. Now, a lot of the trial lawyers didn't want me to sign any bill at all, but I thought we ought to do what we could to cut frivolous lawsuits. But they wouldn't make some of the changes that I thought should be made. Now, let me just give you an example. I had a person in the Oval Office who lost a child in a school bus accident where a drunk driver caused the accident directly, but there were problems with the school bus. The drunk driver had no money. Under the new bill, if I had signed it, a person like that could never have had any recovery. I thought that was wrong. So I gave four or five specific examples to the Congress, and I said, prove to me that these people could recover, but we're going to eliminate frivolous lawsuits. I'll sign the bill. But generally, I believe that a president has to be willing to do what he thinks is right. I've done a lot of things that were controversial, my economic plan, my trade position, Bosnia, Haiti, taking on the NRA for the first time, taking on the tobacco companies for the first time. Sometimes you just have to do that because you know it's right for the country over the long run. That's what I've tried to do, and that's what I will continue to do as president.
Senator Dole?
I mean, how does he avoid conflict? Well, I don't know in the case of the trial lawyers. When I look at the trial lawyers, I mean, you're a few million short, you run out to Hollywood and pick up 2 to 4 million. And organized labor comes to Washington, D.C. and puts $35 million into the pot. Now, if these aren't special interests, then I've got a lot to learn. I was there for a while before I left on June the 11th. The trial lawyers, my wife's a lawyer. We're the only two lawyers in Washington trust each other. But we're lawyers. I like lawyers. I don't dislike trial lawyers. But it seems to me there's got to be some end to the frivolous lawsuits, and got to be some cap on punitive damage. You're putting a lot of business people out of business, small businessmen and small business women who paid 70% of your $265 billion tax increase, the largest tax increase in the history of America. I said that one day, and Pat Moynihan, a Democrat, said no. He said, in the history of the world. So I modified it, the largest tax increase in the history of the world. And it seems to me that there's a problem there, Mr. President. And I will address you as Mr. President. You didn't do that with President Bush in 1992.
Mr. President.
Let me say, first of all, I signed a tort reform bill that dealt with civilian aviation a couple of years ago. I approved that I will sign reasonable tort reform. Secondly, Senator Dole had some pretty harsh comments about special interest money. But it wasn't me who opposed what we tried to do to save the lives of children who are subject to tobacco, and then went to the tobacco growers and bragged about standing up for the federal government when we tried to stop the advertising, marketing, and sales of tobacco to children. And it wasn't me that let the polluters actually come into the halls of Congress, into the rooms, and rewrite the environmental laws. That's what Speaker Gingrich and Senator Dole did, not me.
That's not true.
So I believe that we should take a different approach to this and talk about how we stand on the issues instead of trying to characterize each other's motivations. I think Senator Dole and I just honestly disagree.
Well, Senator Dole, let me ask you the same question I asked the president. How do you avoid being influenced by people who contribute money and services to your campaign?
I think it's very difficult. Let's be honest about it. That's why we need campaign finance reform. That's why I reach out to the parole voters, and we've done about all that. We are the Reform Party, the Republican Party, and the parole voters are looking for a home ought to take a look at the Republican record. Whatever it is, whatever the checklist was in 92, it's all done but campaign finance reform. I worked with Senator Mitchell, who played me, I guess, in the debate warm-up. We tried 6 or 8 years ago. He appointed three people. I appointed three people to get campaign finance reform. We couldn't get it done because it wasn't enforceable. You suggested a commission. Newt Gingrich did. I've suggested that at least 4 or 5 years ago. We have a commission on campaign finance reform. They sent it to Congress, and we have to vote it up or down. That's how it works. We're never going to fix it by the parties, because Democrats want a better advantage themselves. We want a better advantage as Republicans, and that's not how it's going to work. But I want to touch on this tobacco thing. I know the president's been puffing a lot on that. But I want to go back to 1965. That was my first vote against tobacco companies, and I said we ought to label cigarettes. And I've had a consistent record ever since 1965. We passed a bill in 1992 that encouraged the states to adopt programs to stop kids from smoking. All 50 states did it. It took 3.5 years. It wasn't until election year, Mr. President, you ever thought about stopping smoking. What about drugs that have increased double in the last 44 months? Cocaine's up 141%, or marijuana. Cocaine up 166%. I mean, it seems to me that you have a selective memory, and you know, mine doesn't work that way, so I just want to try to correct it as we go along.
And that, of course, is Republican presidential candidate Bob Dole facing off with the Democratic candidate and current president Bill Clinton talking about campaign money and drugs. Larry?
Well, they're right. The system itself is never going to fix this, but they're wrong when they say they're not influenced by it. There is so much abundant evidence. You can read the entire book, The Selling of the President, 1996, Chuck Lewis's book from the Center for Public Integrity. You can listen to Democracy Now.
Right, the buying of the
Ellen,
president.
Buying
it's
president,
selling
thank
too.
You very much. Selling, buying, that's part of the same process. Ellen Miller from the Center for Responsive Politics appears frequently on this show. There are direct lines that can be traced all the time between campaign donations to Bob Dole and Bill Clinton and actions they take or don't take. The system, the idea of calling the Republican Party the Reform Party, which is some little trial balloon that they flew, if you remember, at the beginning of the Republican convention, is ludicrous. There is absolutely nothing about campaign finance reform of any meaningful nature that's been discussed in the Republican or the Democratic Party platform, for that matter. It is going to have to be done by a citizens' movement from outside, and as we've reported on this program, states like Maine, states like California and Colorado have such measures on the ballot this time. That's where we're going to have to look for campaign finance reform from the bottom up, not from this very, very rarefied and, as you say, hideously overfunded top-down system.
And Larry, for these guys trying to act like they are leaders, there's a lot of buck passing here when it comes to why there isn't campaign finance reform, as they talked about attempting to do it back and forth. Well, they are the two most powerful people. They were the Senate Majority Leader, Dole was until June, and here is the president, and neither of them have done it. The idea of the buck stopping there, the buck stopping here, only works for the actual buck stopping in both of their coffers. Well,
I think that's true.
Yeah, I don't think there's much more to be said on it, except that you're right. There's no question it's going to come from a citizen movement. On the issue of liberal that has come up over and over again, that president that Bob Dole has been hammering away at, he seems to have his themes. One is the 15% tax cut. The other is drugs. Again, of course, they didn't mention the whole issue of the CIA's involvement with drugs that's come out in the San Jose Mercury News. And the other, of course, is this issue of liberal. So let's go to that segment of the debate.
And you know, this liberal charge, that's what their party always drags out when they get in a tight race. It's sort of their golden oldie, you know. It's a record they think they can play that everybody loves to hear. And I just don't think that dog will hunt this time. The American people should make up their own mind. Here's the record. We cut the deficit 4 years in a row for the first time since before the Civil War. I mean, before World War II, and maybe before the Civil War, too. We've got 10.5 million new jobs. We've got record numbers of those new small businesses. We made every one of them eligible for a tax cut. We've got declining crime rates, 2 million fewer people on welfare rolls before welfare reform passed, and a 50% increase in child support, and a crime bill with 60 death penalties, 100,000 police, and the assault weapons ban. The American people can make up their mind about whether that's a liberal record or a record that's good for America. Liberal, conservative, you put whatever label you want on it.
Well, I think it's pretty liberal. I'll put that label on it. I mean, you take a look at all the programs you've advocated, Mr. President. Thank goodness we had a Republican Congress there. The first thing you did when you came into office was send up a stimulus package. Say, we got a little pork we want to scatter around America, $16 billion. And even some in your own party couldn't buy
Clearly,
that.
President Clinton does not like to be called a liberal, Larry, and he's proving it with one of the things that I think is most telling. This crime bill, the crime package, the crime law that it is now, that includes 60 versions of the death penalty.
Yeah, but you know what, Amy? Here's another place where you need a reality check. The federal government does not enforce laws on the crimes that are targeted in those death penalty cases. There's only one person, to my knowledge right now, in the federal system who is threatened with a death penalty. There are more than 3,100 people on death row in state prisons. The federal government's role, over and over again, both Bob Dole and the Republicans and the Democrats say, we believe in devolving power to the states. The states should rule. Everything should be state controlled. Let's get everything out of Washington. And yet, when it comes to demagoguing the crime issue, they'll pass 160 different death penalties that'll never be applied. It has absolutely nothing to do with reality and everything to do with demagogic politics.
And of course, the issue that wasn't raised, the issue of race, is key when you're looking at the death penalty, because every study shows that if you have killed a white person, whether you're white or a person of color, you're much more likely to get the death penalty than if you kill a person of color.
Well, the whole question of liberal, 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 I think President Clinton, that was the point in the debate when President Clinton began to visibly relax, because that clearly was a question he was prepared to answer, and it was his only sort of laugh line of the night thing about that being one of Bob Dole's greatest hits.
You know, I think of Bush and Michael Dukakis squaring off and Bush saying, you know, you're a card-carrying member of the ACLU, and I'm waiting for the presidential candidate who simply says, yes, and I'm proud.
We have a long wait, Amy.
Well, let's move on to an issue that is often considered liberal, and that is the issue of concern about education.
I think my ideas are better for the future. Senator Dole voted against student loans, against Head Start, against creating the Department of Education. If he gets elected president, we'll start the new century without anyone in the cabinet of the president representing education and our children. I personally don't think that's the right kind of future for America, and I think we ought to take a different tack.
Senator Dole, do you still favor eliminating the Department of Education?
Yes. I didn't favor it when it was started. I voted against it. It was a tribute after President Carter's election to the National Education Association, who sent a lot of delegates to the Democratic Convention, who give 99.5% of their money to Democrats and the president. And a lot of the teachers send their kids to private schools or better public schools. So what we want to do is call opportunity scholarships. Now, some say, oh, you're a Republican. You can't be reaching out to these people. I've reached out to people all my life. I've worked on the food stamp program proudly and the WIC program and the school lunch program with senators like George McGovern, Hubert Humphrey, and others, to name a few of my Democratic friends. I'm not some extremist out here. I care about people.
Bob Dole talking about caring about people and the issue of education. I don't know where he got that figure that most teachers' kids are in private schools.
Well, it certainly is true that the president and vice president's children are in private schools, and elsewhere in that discussion he mentioned that, and President Clinton didn't respond to it. And here again, one of the major issues in politics is always hypocrisy, and I think that that scores some points. Bob Dole's daughter, of course, being well into her 40s now, was educated a long time ago, and as far as I know, went to public schools. But the question here, Amy, is an extremely important one, and next to economics, surveys of the public indicate that education is the thing that's most on people's minds. And they did kind of grapple with it last night, although they were impeded in doing so in a meaningful way by the terrible moderation role of Jim Lehrer, who asked all kinds of silly, off-the-point questions about their personal feelings about each other and never really got into specifics. The question of abolishing the Department of Education is extremely important. What does the Department of Education do? President Clinton had a point here where he could have stressed the necessity for standards, the necessity for testing, the necessity for developing good textbooks, the necessity for developing technology for the future and computers and schools and all those things. And he blew it. He did not respond in a meaningful way. He went off into other areas about how he supports school choice, too, and maybe charter schools, although the record is mixed. The whole question of the National Education Association being slammed so heavily by Bob Dole at the Republican convention played extremely badly in the country because people don't dislike school teachers. What they dislike is bad education. And it's clear that the government on some level has to be part of that.
Well, Larry, we're going to move next to Ralph Nader, who does take on the issue of education and the way that people really do think about it, the crumbling infrastructures, the need to have better teachers, etc. But on that comment on Jim Lehrer, yes, Jim Lehrer, let's not forget, was chosen by both parties. And there's a reason why a journalist is chosen by both parties, is they're not threatened by what they have to ask. Larry, thanks very much for joining us this morning. Larry Bensky, our national affairs correspondent. Up next, we're going to hear from a man the nation didn't get to hear from last night, consumer activist and Green Party presidential candidate Ralph Nader. You're listening to Democracy Now! We'll be back in 60 seconds. Listening to Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. One of the independent voices excluded from last night's debate was consumer advocate Ralph Nader, the presidential candidate for the Green Party. The Bipartisan Commission on Presidential Debates decided to exclude Nader, Reform Party nominee Ross Perot, Libertarian Party candidate Harry Brown, Natural Law Party candidate John Hagelin from the presidential debates. Late last month, Ralph Nader participated in a forum in New York City called Progressives and the 1996 Elections. Because you didn't get to hear Nader take on Clinton and Dole last night in the debates, we've decided to let you hear Nader do just that on This Morning After.
I don't want to focus on my campaign. That's not really what we're here for. We're here for wither politics now and in the future. I do want to say, however, I think this is an excellent year in order to divert one's ordinary preference for the bad over the worst and go for a more progressive alternative because of several reasons. One is Clinton is very much ahead of Dole. He is too unprincipled ever to lose to Dole. And Dole... by not letting Dole turn his right flank, and Dole is not able to reinvent himself. He is, as the title of a book last year by one of his former staff, a senator for sale. Now, when you are in a state where the bad is so far ahead of the worst, 20, 30 points, you're entitled not to throw away your vote on the leading bandwagon, but to deny that vote by showing that you can help accumulate a progressive alternative vote that will answer now and more in the future this assertion by the bad that we have nowhere to go except to stay home and vote for the bad over the worst. That nowhere to go is one of the most outrageously arrogant political tactics in our generation. Secondly, we must always ask ourselves, if we lower our expectations, and that becomes personally institutionalized in our mind, every 2 years, every 4 years, we're going to be demoralized, and the more demoralized we are, the more we're going to drop out, the more we are going to have both sides of the same coin, apathy on one side, powerlessness on the other. And that's what's going on. When you see people who vigorously disagree with the corporate Democrats on all kinds of issues, and they say, well, we just got to go along, that is a serf on your knees mentality that is demeaning to one's self-respect and ability to look at one in the mirror. And for the half of the people in this country who never vote or do not vote, they have some reason to vote. They have some reason to go, because one of the tenets, I might add, of the Green Party is a permanent binding, none of the above, on every ballot line, so that if people do not like the candidates on the ballot, their option is not just to stay home and be called dropouts. They can go and vote none of the above, and as binding none of the above, if it wins, it cancels the election, sends the candidates packing, orders new elections in 30 days. Now, I think that from time to time, politics' central contention ought to be the distribution of power in a society. In our country, we've seen, especially in the last 15 years, a growing concentration of power and wealth in fewer and fewer hands, usually global corporations, and their control over small business, and their control over government, and their ability to corner consumers with minimal bargaining power, corner workers with minimal negotiating power, close off access to the courts, close off access to the village square, virtually. The public space of gathering is shrinking. You've got malls now that are private property, and it's a tribute to the ethical society that we have this gathering space today. I might add that the concentration of power and wealth is not just private wealth. It's the concentration of private wealth over public wealth, over our public lands, over our pension trusts, over our public airwaves, over our mutual insurance assets, all of which are legally owned by people, legally owned, but not controlled by them. They are owners of these commonwealths, but they are not in control. Who's in control are the banks, the insurance companies, and the broadcast companies, and other corporations who control what we legally own, the public airways. And the one-third of America, with all its natural resources, offshore and onshore, $4 trillion, which could control the major corporations through their stock investments. Instead, the workers don't have any control over those investments. And workers' pension money have been used to fuel this merger and acquisition mania that does not create any new wealth, does not create any new jobs, lays off a lot of workers, and enriches investment bankers and corporate lawyers beyond their dreams of avarice. And it's worker money that's being used here. And here we are, a spectacular expansion of communication technologies, more stations, more cable channels, more other ways to communicate, telecommunications. And yet, our ability as people to communicate to one another with the exception of the internet. Who long how that's going to last before they close or overprice that? Our ability to communicate has shrunken and shrunken. And even visible national citizen leaders are down to sound bites on TV. You're down now to 6 to 7 seconds. If you're interviewed by any of the networks on any issue, if you don't put it in 6 to 7 seconds, they won't consider it. If you put it in 4 seconds, you increase your probability. If you grunt, you even increase your probability. I was just reading the Lincoln-Douglas debates. Can you imagine those people reduced to sound bites? I suspect if we don't have more access and control over more channels, the labor channel, why not? We're going to get 500 cable channels soon. How many movie rerun and home shopping channels? We give these cable companies monopoly rights. What do we get in return? There should be a student channel nationwide. There's not a single 30-second. There's not a single 30-minute national program anywhere devoted to what serious activities students at universities and colleges are engaged in. If a Martian visited the Earth and just looked at television, the Martian would say that universities and colleges, all they do is play football, basketball, and baseball, and some hockey. We're moving from a sound bite public communication system to a sound bark. You know what the difference is? Here it is. I fully expect within 5 or 6 years, someone to come up to a consumer or environmental activist and say, well, let's take the Federal Reserve. And they say, could you please tell me your opinion on the recent Federal Reserve decision to raise interest rates? And so, well-conditioned, like Pavlov's specimen, the citizen advocate goes like this. Eh. And the reporter says, would you care to elaborate? And the citizen activist says, uh-uh, keeper, you're on. That's the sound bark. This is what's happening to us. When you try to propose new solutions to our problems, when you try to describe new activities at the grassroots that are ignored because the late evening news is street crime, sports, and weather, starting in the Cascades, you know, maybe even Alaska. You cannot get it into 6 seconds. And if you can't get it into 6 seconds, you can't communicate, you're shut out. It's become beyond caricature. It's a farce, a tragedy. We've got to put an end to it. They are using our property, the public airwaves. Global corporations are on a collision course with American democracy, and American democracy is losing, and so are tens of millions of people who are paying the price in health and safety and destruction of hope for their future descendants and generations. Our standard of living for 80% of the people in this country, in terms of wages adjusted for inflation, have been going down for 20 years. This is unprecedented in history, short of a major depression. And what have we had in the last 20 years? A growing GNP, record corporate profits, record stock market prices, staggering executive compensation and bonuses and stock options, at the same time that 80% of the people have been sliding backwards. And there's a divergence now. It's no longer a growing economy lifts all boats. It lifts all yachts. If this was not descriptive of the USA, you would think it's descriptive of the banana republics, as they are contemptuously called. Depending on which study you rely on, the wealth of the top 1 to 2% of people in this country is equal to the wealth of the bottom 90%. That's 90 Americans equal to the wealth of 1 to 2 of them. In terms of stock equities through pension investments and others, we tend to be told that we've got a people's capitalism. Listen to these figures. 5% of the richest people in this country own over 75% of the equities. The bottom 80% of this country owns less than 2% of the stock equities. And if you look at the concentration of power over public wealth and the control over pension plan investments and the control over our national resources and the control over our politics and our government, it's in the hands of even fewer giant corporations with their leverage over the rest of the political economy. Notice the dramatic, even hyper-medieval comparisons here. They are grotesque when you actually get down to the specifics. A few days ago, President Clinton signed the military appropriations bill. The Congress gave him $11 billion more than the Pentagon asked for. $11 billion. Now, he signed it. You know his motto, a mind is a terrible thing to make up. Now look what was denied. Look at the struggle. Well, what about $500 million for Amtrak, National Passenger System, rail system? Can't afford it. What about $300 million for legal services for the poor? Can't afford it. What about $100 million to enforce the job health and safety laws, which involve 100,000 lives lost a year to trauma and toxics? Oh, can't afford it. What about child health immunization? A few millions of dollars. Can't afford it. What about $15 million for meat and poultry inspection? Whoa, we can't afford it. What about another $40 million for motor vehicle safety standards? 43,000 dead a year. Can't afford it. Those are the arguments. They didn't all hold sway, but have you added up the figures I just gave? I mean, they're not even $1.5 billion, but $11 billion with a little squib in the newspapers goes to more weapons systems, goes to defend the prosperous countries of Europe and East Asia who are eating our lunch and who can well defend themselves against these enemies. Who are their enemies? Who are their enemies? Reagan's Assistant Secretary of Defense, Larry Korb, is now with the Brookings Institution, and he's talking about cutting the military budget down to $150 billion, making it even leaner by conventional standards. That would release $120 billion right there. Do you know America's crumbling in its public works? You want jobs? You have a massive public investment program to rebuild and repair this country. Mass transit, the schools. Mass transit, the sewage systems, the drinking water systems, the crumbling schools. Look at New York City's schools. What a disgrace. You've got the glitter of the glitterati and the wealth in this city, and they can't even have enough chairs, enough desks, enough books, enough non-leaking roofs for the schools while these oligarchs are making themselves hyper-rich. I think when the history of our generation is written, a lot of the concentration of power and the abuse of power and the appropriation of public assets and the distortion of priorities come because the super rich want to be hyper rich. Look, for example, for $1 billion every 2 years, money interest by the U.S. government. This has to be the best investment in the history of the world. About $500 million a year go into campaigns, presidential and congressional. Now, how do we buy back our own federal government? Well, legislation that provides for a well-promoted voluntary checkoff on the 1040 tax return up to $100 per person, plus some free time on our public airwaves, radio and TV for ballot-qualified candidates, plus lowering some of the entry barriers to new parties and new candidates, and we'd have a remarkably cleaner political system. And right now, NBC, they dangled 400 new jobs before the mayor of New York and before the governor of New Jersey. Said, here's a new cable channel. Here's 400 new jobs. Who's going to bid? Who's going to bid? Who's going to give us tax breaks? Who's going to give us all kinds of corporate welfare? And no 5 years and you're out. Who's going to bid? And the governor of New Jersey won the bid. And one of the goodies that they gave the two richest, most profitable corporations nearly in the country, General Electric and Microsoft, was that in the next 10 years, 80% of the state income taxes to the state of New Jersey paid by those 400 workers will be refunded to General Electric and Microsoft. Shame on you, Bill Gates. Shame on you, Jack Welch. May you become household names. Now, just look at the issues that Clinton and Gore will not discuss. Whatever happened to energy independence? We're importing half our oil. They're not even putting it on the table, energy policy. Instead, they're continually subsidizing nuclear power and some subsidies of oil and gas and coal. They're not pushing solar energy. It's been proven in areas all over the country, solar thermal, photovoltaics, wind power, 1,600 megawatts commercially into the grid in California. Why aren't we embarked in a national renewable and energy efficiency program? Universal health insurance, huh? That was the banner issue for Clinton in 1992. It isn't even in the Democratic Party platform. It's been dropped. They now use the phrase access to health care, not universal. Well, they got their health insurance, members of Congress, terrific health insurance, White House. They've got their own socialized medicines called Bethesda Naval Hospital, Walter Reed Army Hospital. They've got theirs. This is real leadership by moral example, isn't it? The closure of the courts. It is no minor matter to take people who don't have a level playing field up against abuses of power, and they have a chance in the courts. With all their warts, it is a more level playing field, trial by jury of one's peers, etc. And they're not talking about that either. They're not talking about the destruction of civil liberties. There are bills now that are laws that even the nation hasn't discovered how bad some of these provisions are going to be, and not just to legal immigrants, but to all Americans. They're not talking about corporate crime wave. The Wall Street Journal is the main reporter in our country of corporate crime. You don't have to go to some other small journal. The Wall Street Journal has so much information on corporate crime, it could be renamed the Crime Street Journal. Stealing from investors and savers, the savings and loan debacle. From 1990 to the year 2020, we will be paying $500 billion in principal and interest to bail out the crooks in the savings and loan. $500 billion. And then there's one after the other, ripping off shareholders, occupational health and safety violations, bribing government officials, cheating consumers, on and on and on. They don't even talk about it. Oh, you know, they want to crack down on crime in the streets, but they ignore crime in the suites.
And you're listening to Ralph Nader. He is the Green Party presidential candidate. We'll be back with him in 60 seconds here on Democracy Now! You're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman, and on this morning after the first presidential debate, we do continue to bring you a man who is excluded from that debate, Green Party presidential candidate Ralph Nader. This was the end of his speech.
Finally, the tools of democracy. What are the roles that we play? Do you know when you go into a new political movement that has a fresh start, you say first and foremost to yourself, how am I going to really build it? How am I going to really contribute to it? How am I going to really develop new strategies and get my neighbors and friends around it? When there were those big anti-nuclear rallies here in New York a few years ago, there were people who came to those rallies and didn't know anything about what was going on. And they began to learn and study and read. And out of those rallies came the principal opponents, the citizen opponents of the Indian Point plants. And in so many ways, the very fact that there's activity, there's a movement, we're off of our knees, will bring in more and more people than leaders and the dynamic motivators and organizers and workers for a progressive democracy in our country. And maybe we might even help export it. That is an intangible benefit to moving into new progressive directions instead of getting on our knees before the sodden, soggy, torpid, corrupt, self-disgusting two-party system that now masquerades as the holders of the banners of our democracy. Let me end on this note, and that is that all politics begins with a self-realization of how much an individual counts. And if we go through life saying we're going to settle for the least of the worst, or even worse, if we go through life saying you can't fight City Hall or Exxon, and you're willing to tolerate a government of the Exxons by the General Motors for the DuPonts, because they will always have their way, there's something that happens to the human spirit. Some people just drown themselves in alcohol. Some people just get so depressed because it affects their personal life, their standard of living, their opportunities, their very humanity. Some people will just waste a lot of time staring at TV, gazing at TV, 25, 30, 40 hours. They'll live through celebrities and athletes in sports teams. And their children will do so likewise. And our children are being raised in a world of commercially animated cellulose. And they're gazing, and they're eating junk food, and gazing. And the videos are getting more violent, and now they're interactive, and the children can actually do the dismemberment and engage in the mayhem, Mortal Kombat style, and worse is coming. And our youngsters are more out of shape and more overweight than any youngsters since records were kept in 1900. And it's because they are not given purpose, they're not given interest, they're not given the responsibility that their young idealism can aspire to. Look what Children's Express has done for youngsters who want to be reporters. They're a wonderful organization. There are good examples all over the country. But if children are left unattended, untutored, unloved, unkept, un-everything, what do you expect they're going to have? They're going to go right into the streets and into the commercial hucksters and their sensual and destructive manipulations of their minds. And so it all starts with the self-realization of the citizen qua citizen. How much time do we spend on our public citizen lives if we want our private citizen lives to be happy, just, and prosperous? And the pursuit of justice is in reality the pursuit of happiness. And one might say the pursuit of happiness is the pursuit of justice. And a society that has abundant justice and the democratic mechanisms to keep generating and renewing and reexamining those patterns of justice is a society that does not need charity. Thank you.
Green Party presidential candidate Ralph Nader speaking recently in New York City. He was speaking on a panel of progressives and the 1996 elections. Among the people who spoke there was Micha Sifri. He's associate editor of The Nation magazine.
Watching the campaign unfold, and especially watching liberals and progressives' involvement as the race has proceeded, I've been struck by all the cognitive dissonance, both among the Clinton supporters and, to be honest, among Greens and Nader supporters as well. On the one hand, there are all those folks from Jesse Jackson on down telling us that this election is a referendum between the forces of light and the forces of darkness. As Jesse put it, writing in The Nation 3 weeks ago, the choice between Clinton and Dole is, quote, a referendum on the anti-people, pro-corporate, anti-government, radical right, Gingrich Dole agenda. Well, in my opinion, it's not, unfortunately. I think maybe abortion is the sole major exception. I won't count Clinton's defense of affirmative action, which at best you have to call a non-abandonment. After all, he and the Democratic Party in California are doing absolutely nothing to oppose the California Civil Rights Initiative, which will try to abolish affirmative action. Think of all the things that Clinton and Dole agree on, that cash assistance to poor children should no longer be a federal guarantee, while $200 billion in corporate welfare should go untouched, that Medicare and Medicaid should be cut while military spending is increased, that the private market is the only way to reform health care. Where Clinton once called for universal health care coverage in his 1992 campaign, now all he says is he'll appoint a commission to study how to better regulate HMOs and managed care. Where does that leave the 40 to 60 million people who have no health insurance? I tend to think of the fight between Clinton and Dole as being an argument over who should drive while we all get to go over the cliff. Or to take one particularly galling example, who can make gasoline cost even less while we literally drive our cars off the global warming cliff? And yet there are still people, progressives, who can say publicly, as one of the top editors of Tycoon did just days after Clinton had signed the welfare repeal, that, quote, Bill Clinton still carries the most evocative emotional sense of hopefulness in his human quality. Please. But even though I have a warm feeling for Ralph Nader, and if you read this week's issue of The Nation, you'll find that I, along with my comrade Mark Cooper, think that you should vote for him. And I should make clear here that we're speaking for ourselves. The magazine will make its own position clear later on if it indeed makes an endorsement. I still have a lot of frustrations with this campaign. And I worry that some of the Green activists working on this, in the hopes that there will be some kind of breakthrough between now and November, that Ralph will get into the debates. A lot of people spent a lot of time on that very goal this summer, or that he'll somehow shift the agenda, that these people are going to be burned, and worse, are going to end up blaming their weakness solely on the two-party duopoly, which sure we can blame, or on the mainstream media, which deserves some blame too. But there are some problems with this campaign. Ralph, you've been saying for years that you favor building a third party. But this has got to be one of the most haphazard ways you could go about doing it. You're not raising money. You have no staff. You're doing no active outreach. It sounds noble, but it's not very serious. And there are a lot of people. I'm sorry, it has to be said. I think people like Danny Cantor, who is the national director of the new party, are correct when they complain that Nader and the Greens have done little to bring labor, minorities, or women in any organized fashion, and these are indeed vital constituencies for any new third party or movement, to bring them into the campaign. Now, at the same time, I don't see why the Labor Party or the New Party, certainly in New York State, where Clinton is leading Dole by 59 to 25 points, I don't see why these new parties can't offer a little more support for a Nader vote here. And I also understand, Ralph, why you want to run a no-money campaign, but I don't think that really would stop you from reaching out to these groups, both their leaders and their members, in a more aggressive fashion. Nor have you sought to tap the hundreds of thousands of organizers and canvassers affiliated with the very environmental, anti-toxics, public interest movements and groups that you've played such an important role in nurturing. Why not? Now, we've talked about this, and I know you've correctly warned us about not trying to build anything on the crutch of a national leader's celebrity. But I think, may I humbly suggest, that you've overcorrected for that danger. And the result is that it's almost forcing people to reinvent the wheel. And this leads me to my last question. What's going to be left behind after Election Day, on the ground, when you do it in this fashion? It's easy to get on the ballot, relatively speaking. What's hard is building organization. And I think that's where we have to find a way to take a page from or learn from both the New Party and the Labor Party, even if there's some disagreement about politically which way they're heading. Now, still, I think it's important purely on a national scale that we show that not everyone is in Clinton's pocket. It'll actually be a good thing for Clinton's second term if he feels some heat from the left. And for better and for worse, the Nader vote in 1996 for better and for worse, the Nader vote in 1996 is going to be taken as a very important indicator of that. So even with these reservations, I think it's very important. Right now, in national surveys, and there have been very painfully few that have even asked, but in the latest one that I've seen, we have Clinton at 48%, Dole at 36%, Perot at 6%, Nader at 3%, and Harry Brown at 1%. In New York, it's similar, Nader at 3%. The 5% threshold is actually an important threshold, because it would qualify the Greens around the country for a significant amount of money to build towards the year 2000. I think that's certainly a goal that people can aim for, and hopefully it's one that this campaign will hit.
Joanne Landy, President of the Campaign for Peace and Democracy.
I think it's time we say to President Clinton that we've had enough. We say no. You can't sign a murderous welfare bill. You can't ban gay marriage. You can't pass and sign an obscene military budget of over $250 billion. You can't attack civil liberties. You can't force through a NAFTA agreement. You can't promise us more of the same in a second term and expect us to take it. We're growing up, and we're getting out of an abusive relationship. There's no time like the present to begin building an independent alternative. Now, I know there are people here, including people who were deliberately invited to this forum, who, on the one hand, share with me the belief that we desperately need to begin a new independent politics, but who also feel that we now, in this election, have to hold our nose and pull down the lever for Clinton. And that's their democratic right. They should have every right to have that opinion. But I want to describe why I think that kind of thinking, that lesser evilist approach, is crippling, demobilizing, ruinous, and self-destructive for progressives. And we have to stop doing it, and we have to stop doing it now, if we're ever going to get anywhere in building something new and transforming the American political landscape in the direction that we know is possible. We especially shouldn't do it now when we have a wonderful candidate who's right here among us, who represents the things that we believe in. How can we turn our back on someone who stands for what we believe in and vote for someone who time and time again publicly denounces our values and helps to lead this country in an ever more rightward direction? Now, one of the main arguments that's given for holding your nose and voting for Clinton is that Dole is worse. And I'm not going to contest that. Dole is worse. But what is being said to us? I mean, I've heard this ever since I first started hearing about elections. Well, we have to vote for X, Y, Z Democrat because the Republican is worse. It was true. It is true now. It will probably always be true. It will probably always be true right up to the day that this country goes fascist, is that the Republicans will be worse, the Democrats will be better, but the Democrats will be terrible and will be part of a system that moves us steadily, dangerously, and disastrously towards the right. So it's not...
Joanne Landy, president of the Campaign for Peace and Democracy based in New York, speaking along with Micha Sifri and Ralph Nader and others at an event just a few weeks ago on progressives in the 1996 elections. Democracy Now! Is produced by Julie Drizin. Our engineer is Kenneth Mason. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be right back.